vote to support it. So with no further ado, Tim.
Thank you, John. And you do all realise that the definition of an expert, X is an unknown quantity and squirt is a drip on the pressure, so I'm a bit sure. Can I just reinforce the thanks to NewGen and also for all of us, the future of NewGen is all our future and we wish you guys the very best and with all of us support you any way we can, so just spread that word and we've all got fingers crossed. And I want to try and wind you up a bit, and I know this is being recorded, so I might be a little less fulsome than I might have been otherwise. But the time is important. We, in the next few months, and I mean few months, have got the opportunity to make a big difference. And if we get this right, it's not a Donald Trump quote, we can get back to where we were and even better, but there's a lot to do. And what I thought I'd do is just try and just go back a bit and talk a bit about, first of all, why does this matter? Why does anybody care about all this nuclear stuff? How many of you recognise that page? Right, good. You should all have a look at that. That was the 2050 calculator that DEC put together. It's basically saying, we're going to take carbon out of the system. How the hell do we do it? And you can play with it. So if you just Google 2050 calculator, not the classic version, by the way, not the new code version, so it's not good. But on this thing, when it comes up, you have all the different forms of energy and what you might do to change our behaviour, our use. All the different sources of energy, where they might come from. And on the right-hand side, it shows you what happens to CO2. And you may not be surprised to realise this is unbelievably difficult. It's worth a play just to persuade yourself how horrid it is to change behaviours and problem to try to figure out what the hell the market's going to look like, the energy market. However, the reason this is quite an important tool to play with is that you can do your own thing, and whatever you do, you end up with a mess, because trust me, I spent hours and hours and hours on. I'm not entirely stupid, but it's bloody difficult. So there are a few examples at the top right, which is intentionally scrolled away. If you click on that, you get a drop down of pre-canned examples of different types of solutions. In fact, the examples are there at all. It was a battle, because within governments at the time, there was a real resistance to trying to show what different things might do. So this one is the solution that Friends of the Earth came up with in terms of what they're going to do to take energy out and where it's going to come from and what would then happen. If you look very carefully on this side, getting the CO2 down by 80% to about getting 80% out involve a big chunk of carbon capture, you know, geoengineering, actually these funny trees that suck CO2 out of the air, that's hard. You think nuclear's hard? That's really hard. However, that was the Friends of the Earth solution. How many of you recognise the name David Mackay? Right. The few of you who don't, Google him as well. David died just over 2 years ago. One of the most astonishing people I've ever come across. But David wrote a book out of sheer frustration with the media called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. You can still buy it. If you want to, you can download the PDF. The website is just called withouthotair.com. It's the best book on energy ever written. Don't trust me, trust Bill Gates and Tony Juniper and people like that.
It's free.
It's free if you want to, but actually, given David's left a wife and two little kids, those of you can, please buy one for him. But it's just stunning. And anyway, David and I had the most appalling battle to get included on the examples, the low cost option, which looks like this.
Source of electricity, that.
It's nuclear fission. That's the low cost option. So just pause and think about that. That's why this is really important. That's why nuclear, conventional nuclear, is absolutely vital for our grandchildren in getting the CO2 down. And there's still a tiny smidgen down here of capture, but not much.
Microwave is an issue for the left hand block.
Sorry?
Microwave is an issue for the left hand block.
Yeah.
We're told that if we want to electrify transport, we can do something like treble the electricity supply.
Yeah.
I don't
that's, and that brings me on to the next bit about the ambulance, which is that you're electrifying transport and you're electrifying heat.
That's going to happen. What does that do to the nature of the electricity market? A, the whole thing goes up, but it actually does this. It doesn't do lumps in different places. It shifts the whole baseload up. And try as you might with clever gadgets, you know, we're going to charge your car when we, the system, feel like it. You guys might be nice, peaceful, friendly people, but I'm not. I want my car charged when I want it. And that's going to be overnight and when I'm at work during the day. So as you electrify transport and heat, the need for base load just keeps going up. And one of the battles that still exists in policy making, not just in the UK, is that there are very, very few people who know what the word system means. So for those of you who don't know, a long, long time ago, I used to be a theoretical physical chemist, so I'm a bit of a geek. One of the things that economists do to solve problems is they take the big problem, with apologies to the very eminent economist in the room, but they take the big problem and break it to lots of little bits, deal with the individual little bits, which by that point are linear, so we can do the maths, can't we? And we stick it all back together again. Well, that's fine if you don't change very much. But if you change things in a substantive way, it doesn't fit. Guess what we're doing? We're blowing it up and starting again. The grid has virtually no redundancy in it. It was built to shift power from coal to manufacturing. That's not where we are. It's not where we're going to be. That's all wrong. I tried to explain what I meant by the word system to a very senior civil servant. I won't say who it was. I said, a system is a collection of things that interact and interoperate. And sometimes when you poke the system, it absorbs the poke. That's called negative feedback. Sometimes when you poke the system, it smacks you back in the face. That's called positive feedback. Oh, said the civil servant, I thought positive feedback was what you got on your annual appraisal. And I said, am I actually wasting my time here? And was told, probably. Now, I say that not to be rude about civil servant, because that's not the intent. The point is that we are abusive to them by asking them to make decisions about things that they do not understand. And there'll probably be a quite common reflection across the room that when you walk around Whitehall and you hear big policy developments, I mean, he certainly heard it, and they come up with bright ideas, and you go, that's very interesting. How are you going to do that? And it bubbles along. And when it gets to anything slightly difficult, they say, oh, well, the market sorts that out. Well, there are limits to markets. And the stuff that we're doing in rebuilding the entire energy system in the UK is way beyond the limits to markets. So it's quite complicated. Anyway, that's why nuclear matters, really matters. So this is not a Horizon advert, but at any point, we've got to use whatever's going, whatever's happening that makes the news, that makes people go, oh, that's interesting. So I'm just going to chuck some Horizon stuff up. So we're making progress. We're all making progress. And a bit like an accident anywhere is an accident everywhere, progress anywhere in nuclear is progress everywhere. We all have to use it. And if I ever catch people being tribal between different groups, I'll throttle them. Because we're all in this together. And any success that we make in any of the businesses, others can adapt and grow from. So you know that there's four of them operating in Japan. 9,000 jobs during construction. First sparks out the thing middle of next decade. If you use both sites, it's electricity for 10 million homes. 14.8 million tons of CO2 avoided each year during construction, during operation of the two sites, and 850 real jobs in operation. I mean, that's from a country that's in desperate need of good news. This is all part of it. And just to remind you where it all is, it's right up down the corner of Anglesey, right on the tip. And from CGV days, those who were around tell me that it was viewed as one of the very best sites, along with, if not even as good as Hinkley. But look at the job growth. Look at that, up to 9,000 people, and it's not very far away. And to give you an example of the challenge behind this that needs the whole of industry to grab this with both hands. In about 2012, I was at an NIAID looking at worker needs, worker opportunities during the next decade. Saw the graph like this for the whole industry, where, of course, you're up at 26, 27,000 people. And was frankly quite shocked. And on the way back, I ran into somebody who I'd known before they became an MP and were at that point a junior education minister. and ran to this person in the street and said, oh, hi, nice to see you again. How's the new job? And I said, just been at this event looking at these enormous new jobs, high-skilled jobs. I said, it struck me on the way over here, didn't know I was going to run into you, but we should be rebranding the Department for Education, the supply chain for people. And got a sort of quizzical look. And I said, we have to make sure that when kids leave school, they have the opportunity to make most of their life chances to take these jobs, which means we've got to help them. Oh, no, 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 said my former friend. This is the job of the private sector. They train people. I said, yeah, that's fine, but we have to make sure that they are trainable and they've got the background skills. Oh, no, education is much more complicated than that. And I did get a lecture on the last three announcements from the department. And I said, hey, remember, it's me. You know, we used to do things together before you became MP. It's still me. What's happened to you? What are you going to do about these kids? Because it's now your duty to help the kids make the most of this. So there is an issue, and this again is limits to markets. The world is changing, and government is not going to do much because they're just too distracted, irrespective of your politics, they're just too distracted for some time to come. So industry as a whole has got to be thinking now hard about what we're going to do with this. What are we going to be doing in schools? So all the way through the supply chain, if you're going to be taking even a few of those jobs, your friends are, you need to be in the schools talking to people. You do. Nobody else is going to do it. But just think of the impact on the life chances of kids. Just think on the impact on communities as this lot goes through. It's quite profound. One of the bits from my days as a physical chemist is, those of you who remember your statistical mechanics, if you take an assembly of things, whatever they are, magnets, molecules, people, that interact in a basically monotonic way, if you move them from one state to another, if you do it very slowly and the states are close together, then it's predictable and efficient. And the further apart and the faster you do it, the less predictable, the less efficient it is. What we're going through is an explosion. It's going to be neither. So there's all sorts of inefficiencies in here that we've got to try and deal with to help make sure that the supply chain for people works. Now, one of the whingers, including from the National Infrastructure Commission in the report a few weeks ago, is that this is so expensive. Really? Who told them that? This lot certainly didn't. Have you seen how many of you have seen this report? Right. Those of you who haven't, you get copies of the slides, read it. It's really, really interesting. And it's not. It doesn't have to be. So what these guys did was to look at every new power station built since Three Mile Island and talk to the people who did it and gather a bucket load of data on basis of confidentiality, the usual benchmarking type of process. So if we look at the costs per kilowatt hour, conventional Europe and North America up there, and there's the red line. Rest of the world, by which I mean China, South Korea, Japan, and Abu Dhabi. Who's down there? What the hell is going on that in a country that used to be so proud of its engineering skills and tradition, that we seem to be still part of that left-hand column? We have to do something about this. So it doesn't have to be, first thing. Some of you may know, a lot of you won't, but in my idle moments when I was in Burr, I was the original financial advisor to Abu Dhabi when they started their program. And from the minute that the government decided that they wanted to build these things to the day they signed the contract with the Koreans to build it, guess how long? 11 months. 11 months. That included going around the world, doing the marketing, getting the bids in, assessing them, and making a decision. 11 months. We don't even print planning documents in that time. It's outrageous. It's a country that hadn't built a garden shed with instructions before. Somebody else had done it. But they did it. It can be done. This is not difficult. This isn't about nuclear physics. That was done when I was in short trousers. It's a long time ago. This is very difficult. We can do it better. Look at the electricity costs. So that's where they've got a reference PWR model. This is straight out of their book. These are two that matter. Conventional Europe, North America, that's the 6% cost of capital, 7%, 9%. 100 bucks. The rest of the world is about $55. Less in dollars than in UK sterling for most of the time. Next time somebody says £57.50 for a wind farm is good value, cobblers. We can do better than that. One of the things that they discovered, and this is in the, with apologies, the no-shit Sherlock category, is that if you finish the design and the construction planning before you let anybody on site, it tends to be cheaper and on time. Well, really? But they've got stats to prove it. Those are a number of plants where they actually managed to get a design completion of site construction, and that's the result. Statistically, very significant. Simple, basic stuff. One of the things that, going forwards, whether it's Sizewell or Horizon or Moorside, there should be an absolute lock on the gate until somebody rocks up with a set of designs which are basically down to the field engineering level. And by field engineering, I mean little bits about where the screw goes, not anything more than that. Because that's how you, that partly how you get the numbers down. One of the things that the team also did was they talked to project managers, the guys who'd actually run the things. So they got a lot of qualitative stuff as well, all of which backed all this up. And it was interesting, one of the project managers said, of course, when you get to the point where you made a financial decision to commit and you've raised the money, that then burns a hole in people's pockets and they let contracts. When they let contracts, of course, the contractor wants to start work now and comes up with phrases like, well, my best guys are ready for this. If I don't start work tomorrow, they'll go on to something else. So there's all sorts of stupid incentives. And if you haven't got that right at the end of design completion, you'll end up building a complete camel. Not difficult stuff, though. These were the main findings out of it. And again, most of this is such motherhood and apple pie. Complete plant design prior to starting construction. Really? Follow contracting best practice. Really? Project owner should develop multiple units at a single site. Well, how hard is that one? Innovate new methods for developing alignment with labour around nuclear projects. There are projects in the States where they've got the unions on the board of the project. It kind of helps. Government support should be contingent on systematic application of best practice and cost reduction measures. Well, government's involved like the pig is for breakfast rather than the hen. They're committed to it. With big infrastructure projects, whether it's Thames Tideway or big roads or power stations, government owns failure. And they've got to get better at being part of it. We'll skip that one for a minute because that's a bit political. But government has to play a role in supporting financing processes. By the time Hinckley got to final investment decision, I think we probably have to move around. So I'll keep things going. No? In which case, well done for energy economy, NuGen. If you think about it, EDF spent nearly 3 billion quid by the time they started work on site. Horizon's going to be about the same. As a development cost, that is outrageous. There are no companies I can think of in Western Europe with a balance sheet that can afford to risk even a fraction of that. So the government's involved, whether they like it or not. And we need to get them to a position where they're being more sensible about it. And they are making good progress. And for the guys from ONR, transform regulatory interaction to focus on cost-effective safety. So the one that's outstanding in the UK is when we come to the next generation of smart modular reactors, not small. We need to get to the point where we can license test reactors, not quite like that, but pretty close to, run it for 5 years and throw it away. But we need to be able to develop these things without the entire panoply of complexity. Now, there are two numbers that you need to commit to memory for gigawatt scale reactors. For every £1 billion change on the CapEx, you change the strike price in the UK by about 8 quid-ish. It's good enough. But for every 1 percentage point on the cost of capital, it's 13. 13 quid. So those of you who had the misfortune to hear me do speeches when I worked in Whitehall, I used to say every single time, the only two numbers that matter in nuclear are capital cost and cost of capital. Everything else, price of fuel, cost of labour, doesn't matter. Those two are the killers. So how do you get the weighted average cost of capital down? Well, you de-risk it for a start. You don't let the process be financed when there's a lot of risk left in it. You de-risk it through quality design and effort up front. What else do you do? Well, you make sure that there is a source of risk-taking money that understands the risks in nuclear, as opposed to some of my former colleagues who just see this as an opportunity for massive yield. It's not. this is not a risky process if it's done sensibly. And I said to a couple of ministers that I worked for, if they gave the wrong sort of speech during the financing process for a nuke, they could probably add a couple of quid for every megawatt hour to the price of electricity out of that unit just by their speech. Because you can shift, you know, 10, 15, 20 basis points from a speech without any problem at all on something like this. But that is really sensitive. So remember those numbers. The most important thing to do, you've got to get the cost to the point where it's sensible and trustworthy, but you've got to take the cost of capital right down. Because if you don't, all you're doing is you're taxing the future users of electricity. So what do we need to do now? Well, first of all, for the next of a kind gigawatt scale, by which I mean what comes after Hinkley and Horizon, we've got a different financing mechanism. So the Hinkley mechanism is only ever going to work when you've got a state behind it with an infinitely deep pocket. And I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. But similarly for Horizon, the deal that we'll end up with for Horizon is absolutely a one-off. And the blood that's been spilt to get there is astonishing, frankly. But if we're going to do the SMRs as well, the first of those, it has to be different. Even though the capital cost is a lot less, you don't just simply go out to the venture funds and say, well, sovereign wealth funds won't do it anyway unless they're stupid. You've got to think about this more sensibly and creatively. And there is a bit of work going on, which I'll talk about in a minute. But to get an idea of the Chinese vision of this sort of thing, when Horizon was up for sale, I was basically wandering around the world on behalf of HMG trying to persuade people to buy it. And I went to see one of the nuclear power companies in China with some guys from DEC. And they'd assembled an enormous meeting. And the first person we were introduced to by the head of this nuclear power company was the CFO of Three Gorges Dam. And I thought, that was interesting. I mean, I know our talks are really fascinating and you can charge a good price, but what the hell's he doing here? Oh, said the nuclear guy, the government built the dam. He now just collects the revenue. He hasn't got a clue what to do with it. Ah, I said, he's your banker. Yes, he said, that's right. Completely different model. There's no sense of a treasury sitting there thinking, well, I've got threats to spend this week. What can I put it on? Completely different view where they take a strategic view. Because fundamentally what you're doing in rebuilding the energy system in the UK is we're determining the national economic competitiveness of our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's the importance of what we're doing. So that's the first thing that has to be done. We've got to get down below the cost of capital. There's one other zinger, and apologies for me, it's a bit of a banker's thing. When you finance a project up to a point when it works, from the financier's point of view, it's scary. The minute you proved it works, which in the case of a nuke is the first refueling, and it does actually restart when ONR searches, you can put the lid on and it's still intact. At that point, the risk has collapsed and the cost of finance equally collapses. So what you're doing is you're taking a bunch of finance at the beginning, which is very expensive, relatively high margin, and you replace it with cheap stuff. What that produces is that difference in financing is a gain which can be extracted as cash on the day. And you see this a lot in the PFI deals. And we got to a point where a bit over 50% of the gain went back to the public sector, but half of it leaked out. If you have a big gap between the financing cost, as in the WACC during construction and the WACC during operation, half of that leaks out. So you've got to bring this down as close as you can by whatever means you can to minimise the stupid leakage at that point. So that's the point about refi data books. And this is really the point. State capital is always the cheapest. Now, it's actually not. It's only the cheapest because it's completely mispriced. And the analogy I'll give you is the PFI deals. So on PFI deals, you look at the private sector is going to do, and you say, dear Mr. Private Sector, please do this, but we'll give you some of the risks, but not all. That's the way all the deals work. The debt rating on those PFI projects is somewhere in the BBB range, which is translated into just above junk. Well, if it's just above junk, having transferred some of the risk, if you transferred all of the risk, it absolutely will be 24 carat junk. And if it's 24 carat junk in a PFI deal, why is it not 24 carat junk in the public sector's books? And the answer is it is, but nobody measures it, because if it ever, when things go wrong, you know what happens. They chop the budget over there, or they move some money somewhere else, or they put the tax up, but there's no proper accountability. But nonetheless, with the system that works, state capital is the cheapest. There's another way of doing it using what's called regulated asset base, which is the way the water companies and regulated monopolies have been financed. And there's a bit of effort going into that at the moment. But the problem is, the way that works is that once you've built an asset, somebody says to you, that thing has a regulatory asset base of 12 billion quid. And what they then do is they allow you to earn a rate of return on that, which is a quasi-market rate. They work out what they think the market rate is, and your price is then set based by that. Problem is, there are three problems. First one, how do you get from an actual construction cost to an allowed asset base number? What happens in the States is that between the developer and the regulator, they sit down and say, we think this is a reasonable price. At which point then the builder goes off and starts building, and every time he gets a $100 million check, he has to pay to the contractor. He sends the bill to the regulator, who promptly says, ooh, 100 million? You should have done that for $87.374498 million. Which point the developer says, oh, maybe I should, but I didn't. I did my best, that's it. Oh, this is the regulator. Well, I'm only going to allow you the 87 million. At which point, it becomes the full employment act for accountants and lawyers on both sides. And you then see this other parallel construction process of professional advisors earning prodigious amounts of money, arguing the toss over the seventh decimal place of what's an allowable construction cost. I know a lot of guys in the States who will never do that ever again as long as they live. So that's problem one. How do you get from actual cost to a ramp? Second one is, how's the cost of capital going to be set in the future? And just to get the context at the moment, in the water industry, they're just going through the business plan for 2020 through 2025. And the regulator has decided that the cost of capital is 2.6%. So the equity and the debt together, how would they raise it? They're allowed 2.6%. Now, I know mattresses that produce better returns when you stick the money under them than that. Why would somebody from an infrastructure fund who's investing on behalf of pensioners invest in something that generates 2.6%? That is utter garbage. And one of the bigger questions here is, to whom are these economic regulators accountable? We'll do that over beer on another occasion, but there's a problem there to be sorted out. And the third one is for nukes. As you guys all know, you don't turn nukes up and down, and when you turn them off, they cost more, not less. So how does a nuclear generating unit deal with volume risk, especially in an era when you've got renewables that are must run? What do we do? There's a bit more fun to come around here. So it's about system design. I talked a bit about pace and scale and complexity in the mixed market, but we actually need EMR 2.0, because the EMR that stands there, electricity market reform, doesn't actually work. And if you just stand back a minute, every form of low carbon generation, except carbon capture and storage, is virtually zero marginal cost. So how do I bid that into a market when the market's about price?
Store the heat.
Basically, you can't do it in the current market. You've got to find a different way of doing it. If you don't have a marginal cost, you can't have a bidding mechanism that says next Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock, 10 megawatts, I'll charge you or bid in 45 quid. You can't do it. And if you look at the way that in most countries, the nuclear auctions work, where nuclear is bidding in, they're bidding at zero, because it is zero marginal cost. So we've got to have a completely different approach to this. Where's Ofgem? Have you ever heard Ofgem talk about the need for market redesign? Right. So that's going to have to get sorted at some point too. But with all this, I've got no doubt that it is possible to build a regulated asset-based model which would work for a new gen, it would work for the SMRs in due course, it would work for Horizon, it would work for Sizewell. But you've got some fairly nasty things to deal with. And a regulator who at the moment is far more interested in capping the price of the standard variable tariff than much bigger problems. Anyway, some speeches tend to end with one more thing, and we just had one a couple of weeks ago from Apple, so I thought I'd chuck a few in. So it's quite clear that China is leading the way, beautifully, exquisitely. For those of you who've not been, go have a look at the way that the Chinese are rolling out high-speed rail. And it's like a giant wallpaper brush just going across the country. There'll be 30,000 kilometres by the end of the decade, far more than anywhere else. But they decided to do it. The reactors, which caused so much fuss with Areva and Westinghouse, are gone critical. There's another one with some fuel loads. It's going fine. And they have a plan for the fuel cycle. We used to have one of those once. Don't know what happened to it. But they've got one. They're quite clear that they're going to make it work properly and sensibly. But we are making progress between Hinkley and Horizon, particularly Horizon. There's, and the reason I say that is that it's not because of, I'm not criticising Hinkley, it's old news. All Hinkley's got to do is get on and do it, and frankly, get on with it and do it faster. But there's a view around Whitehall that Horizon is the next shiny new toy, and we've got to get that over the line. Because until that's over the line, it's still in the experimental era quality. But there is, there's real interest and real enthusiasm, so we should be able to do it. I think you'll see some interesting developments on SMRs from government back into this year and next year. I've got a reasonable idea what's going to happen, but there's an enthusiasm. There's a real buzz within, not so much Bayes, but Treasury and Number 10. And Number 10 has been fantastic in supporting the future of Horizon going forwards. I was saying to somebody earlier on, trust and confidence is what this is all about. We are making a shocking job of an industry about talking about what we're doing. You know, there's all sorts of mutterings about, oh, well, the UK's not doing anything. You know, there's not. There's stacks happening. Look at the apprentice programs in EDF and Horizon. Look at what the supply chain is doing in tooling up to do this stuff, in empowering people. Look what AMRC is doing. We are making a shocking job of talking about the news, and we need to do that. Because by building trust and confidence, you also build momentum. And the one thing that Whitehall is terrible at is stopping momentum. If things are moving along, they'll cajole to bit and oil bits, and they'll get the curling brooms out and ooze it a bit, but they won't stop it. It's very brave for a civil servant to stop something that's apparently working. And we've got to create, all of us in the industry, a real sense that there is trust and confidence that it's going to work and it'll get there. And at the moment, with that very nice cue from the mics, that's me. Thank you very much. Thank you for the therapy, and thank you for the questions.